Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my coverage from Venice Immersive 2025, today's episode is with a piece called Blur, which is a part of the competition. So this is a co-production between Riverbed Theater as well as Phi. And so Riverbed Theater and Craig Cotero, they've done the trilogy of All That Remains and then Over the Rainbow and then A Simple Silence. I've had Craig on talking about each of these different experiences ever since like 2022 when it first premiered at Venice Immersive. And so it's actually at that premiere at Venice Immersive 2022 that Phoebe Greenberg, who's the founder of Phi, actually saw it and was really quite blown away. And that kickstarted a whole collaboration between Phi and Riverbed Theater. So Craig had been working on a lot of these experiences for one type of encounters. And so how can you start to translate that type of feeling into an immersive experience? They were really pushing the edge of that with these 360 videos and also this type of theater that would be perverting your expectations, kind of pulling the rug out underneath you. And so it was actually my favorite piece at Venice Immersive 2025. I thought it was absolutely incredible and just awe-inspiring. And then I think technologically innovative on so many different levels, just the technical aptitude to be able to pull it off, but also the overall experience was this sense of awe and wonder. And there was a bit of like the semiotic transmission of meaning where there is a bit of like abstractness that you kind of have to piece it together. Or for me, I think actually a lot of the piece, I understood a lot more after this conversation with them and hearing more around their design intent. But as you go through it, it just feels like a bit of the grammar of VR really leaning into this kind of surreal dream logic in a way that I think also pushes the edge for the grammar and telling these stories. But there's also this kind of experience of the blending and blurring of all these different modalities that I'll start to walk through as I talk about this story. So basically the stories around these topics and themes of cloning and the ethics around that and what's it mean to potentially resurrect and bring back life. And so there's this boundary between life and death and the boundaries of that. And so the main story is around a mother who loses her child. And so there's these different scenes of these interfaces between this kind of mashup of this kind of hybrid entities of this reality, unreality. So the piece is called Blur. So that's the theme of the blending and blurring between those. But there's also the theme of how they're blending and blurring all the different communication media. So in terms of the contextual domains, it's these fundamental questions around life and death. And so they say Blur was born out of a, quote, desire to explore the emotional and ethical terrain where science, loss, and imagination collide. So there's lots of these different philosophical and ethical implications of the science of human cloning as explored through the main storyline of a mother who loses her child. And it explores the speculative and imaginal space of the science-based possibilities with these imagery that reflects these kind of moral and ethical dilemmas around these hybrid entities. And also the implications of taking these extinct animals like the woolly mammoth and the direwolf and resurrecting them through science and bringing them back to life. And so that's the different contextual domains that are being explored. And so the main center of gravity, I'd say, in this piece is very much the earth element in terms of the spatial architecture of the space, but also the way that they have all this kind of theatrical staging. And so it's a blend of both virtuality, CGI, cinematic 360 video, 180 video, mixed reality. It's basically all of the realities all mashed together. They even have some live performance and different ways that they have architectural modulations that are unexpected. And so it's all through these integrations of your embodiment. You're not necessarily a character, but you're still kind of this ghostly entity that is embodied and walking through these moments. There is a moment there at the end where it has some live interactive theater interactions. And also in the onboarding, you're very much treated as a person. So there are these moments where you are a character, but you're mostly yourself in those moments, not necessarily representing anybody narratively within the context of the story. So there's lots of different like invisible spatial choreography that's happening in the back end for them to have this like six-person experience in this constrained space that it feels like as you're walking through these virtual spaces, you're kind of walking through these infinite realities, but you are constrained and you also have to be negotiating walking through other people who are also walking through all this. So there's lots of different choreography that's happening on the back end that's completely invisible to the person who's actually going through the experience. But something that I could appreciate both kind of understanding what it took to be able to pull this off, but also in the context of the conversation that I had with them. So overall, it really feels like you're being taken on this vast, expansive spatial journey through time and space, which is really quite remarkable overall. So the center of gravity of the earth element in these spatial contexts and your own embodiment as you're going through it, I think is the core. And then on top of that, I'd say the second center of gravity is the air element in terms of your expectations, your beliefs, your perversion of expectations, perversions of the beliefs. And so there's a lot of playing with surreality, going into these other realms, possibility spaces. And so it's a constant perversion of your expectations and experience, having the quote rug pulled out from underneath you, as Craig Quintero says. So there's a lot of symbolic dream logic and the theater of the absurd. There's also a lot of abstract and semiotic associative linking that Quintero describes as a Rauschenberg-like collage. So it's blending together lots of different various archetypal forms to communicate their message. And there's definitely a narrative to be parsed, but you also have to kind of sort of piece it together, as there's a lot of symbolic communication that's happening. And so as well as this kind of expectation perversion that is also kind of like disruptive. And so it's maybe a little bit more difficult to have a ground when the ground is continually being pulled out and disrupted from underneath you. So in some ways, people can really appreciate that type of disruption of their expectations, and other people could just find it confusing. So I found that there's a bit of a bifurcation between people that were completely blown away and like one of their favorite experiences of all time, and other people that were just like, I don't really know if I really got it. So I think that was a part of the dance of a piece like this, is that it can be a very abstract and also stuff that is difficult to kind of parse all the different symbols as they're coming through in real time. So it can kind of result in this a bit of breaking the plausibility and suspension of disbelief when there's just confusion and people that are saying that they don't get it. But for me, I was just completely filled with a sense of awe and wonder of this possibility space, and just surrendered to the ride of feeling like I was like waking up from a dream. And as I wake up from the dream, I have to kind of like understand and parse what that dream is. And if you ever woken up and being vexed by a dream, this is kind of like what this experience feels like, where there's a lot of connections and digesting and processing that needs to happen. And it would almost be beneficial, I think, to kind of have a group dream-like debriefing for this type of experience. But also, I'm also happy for people to kind of have their own experience to sit with it. You know, you see people coming out of blur and they're like, hair is like at the back of their head and they're just kind of wide-eyed open and just hands up, and they just say, I just need a moment to process what just happened. So again, they're sort of also taking these elements from a theater of one encounter, this one-on-one social dimensions of that, and also packing in elements of that within the context of this piece with these different theatrical moments. You're kind of one by one taking in and onboarded into this piece in this kind of one-on-one encounter type of way. And there's other moments as well throughout the course of the piece where you have this ability to have this gazing and encounter with one of the performers. So the other third center of gravity is the fire element in terms of the different live performative aspects of this. Most of this is on rails in terms of these experiences that you're going on, but there are these mixed reality components with these live actors that are interacting with you at these key moments. And so having the live actors there means that there is a bit of like looking at this in terms of location-based entertainment, to have theater companies that are interested in having like a theater troupe that would also be a part of acting within the context of this piece. So this piece had premiered in Taiwan and it showed at Venice, and it's also had a run within the context of Montreal. And I think they're sort of deciding where it's also going to go. I think this is the type of piece that also isn't like their other pieces where they have like a throughput of like 150 people per hour. This is basically like, you know, 6 or 8 or 10 people, or I don't know how much they're able to get it up to, but it's a lot less. And it's a lot more of a piece that is focusing on the art and the artistic expression of pushing forward what's even possible with a piece like this, rather than something that's a big mass commercial type of blockbuster type of experience. So I'm really glad to see that Phi is like pushing forward and experimenting and just really innovating on a piece like this. I think a lot of people who saw this were deeply inspired. And it's one of those pieces that I found lots of people referring to and speaking about. I'm sure if you go back through some of my conversations from IFA Doc Lab and other people that are kind of casually mentioning that this is like a real landmark piece in my mind. And then finally, the final element of the water element, and these are the different kind of cinematic quality. There definitely does seem like a montage, like you're watching a film edited. And there's a sense of time that is also going backwards in time and kind of like these speculative possibility spaces. And it definitely feels like you're kind of walking into a film edit in that sense. And also very rapidly paced type of piece. It's a piece that there's a lot of stuff that's thrown at you really quickly. So it definitely feels like you're kind of walking into a jump cut edits of lots of stuff that's happening. At least that's my kind of memory of it, was that it's so rich and so many different things to see. And it may not have been fast paced editing like that. It just, I think, is more of the depth of so many range of different things that you see that your brain is kind of trying to like piece it all and integrate it all together. But for me, like I said, it was like one of the best experiences I ever had within VR. And I think it's one of those pieces that I'll be looking back to in terms of like really pushing forward the possibility spaces of the medium. So in terms of the different archetypal themes that are being explored within the context of the story, and then also pulling some quotes for the description. So Blur explores the, quote, fundamental questions of identity and selfhood and what makes me, me. So they're looking into the structures of society and science, mashed up against these dissolving and the dissolution of the boundaries between science and humanity, bringing questions around these archetypal qualities that make us uniquely human. The idealized image of the human form from evolution that also gets dissolved through hybrid combinations that is also amplified through the actual blending and blurring of communication media from mixed reality to virtual reality to the individual versus the collective and these theatrical performances to architecture with a bit of magic that's thrown in there as well to be able to amplify the overall themes of the piece. So there's a lot of these dialectics between the virtual and imaginal and synthetic versus like what is real and what is mortal. There's like life versus death in the context of these scientific truths and technological advance. And then finally, a quote from their description, it says, with cloning and advances in resurrection biology, we have obscured the boundaries between the living and the dead, the natural and the artificial. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Craig and Phoebe happened on Friday, August 29th, 2025 at Venice Immersive in Venice, Italy. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
My name is Craig Quintero. I'm the artistic director of the Taiwan-based Riverbed Theater, and we're returning to Venice for our fourth time. We did three previous works, the Just For You trilogy, All That Remains, Over the Rainbow, and A Simple Silence. And now we're working on this co-production with Phi Studio and Onassis Culture on Blur.
My name is Phoebe Greenberg. I'm the founder and chief creative officer of Phi. I'm also the co-writer and co-director of Blur.
Maybe you can each give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into the space.
So I formed Riverbed Theater in 1998, co-founded it with a group of artists, visual artists, and theater artists, and really sort of exploring how to create these immersive encounters, these immersive experiences for our audience. A lot of my background was with this idea of total theater, so this Gesamtwerk, this Wagnerian term, of really not just focusing on the visual, but also sound and taste and touch, and to really make this total encounter. And so over the years, we did some really small-scale pieces and some large-scale pieces, and about, now how many years ago? 13 years ago, we started doing these live performances for an audience of one, very immersive, very tactile, like a lot of energy focused on one audience member. And from that theatrical live performance approach, we really thought about, well, how could we translate that into something that's more portable? So we started this live performances for an audience of one, the Just For You trilogy that I mentioned that had All the Remains that premiered in 2022, and taking that into now a virtual world, you know, really thinking about the intersections of the performing arts, the visual arts, of creating these encounters. So not to create a show or something to see, but to really create an experience.
I began my journey in the theater. I graduated from the Jacques Lecoq School in Paris. Following a couple of decades of a theater practice, I got really interested in developing a foundation and a center for an infrastructure supporting contemporary art and encouraging audiences to have accessibility to some of the best contemporary art of our time. About a decade ago, I met Felix and Paul and had my first experience in VR and became hooked almost immediately, and over the years developed opportunity for location-based exhibitions. I then, during the pandemic, developed with Felix and Paul Studios and Phi Studio a large-scale immersive piece called The Infinite, which sort of led us on a journey to expand the studio and create new works in this format and challenge the boundaries of what the technology has to offer.
And Craig, I know we've had a number of conversations over the years about each of your pieces, and maybe we'll take it back to Venice of 2022. So I understand that this project Blur kind of started with Phoebe seeing All That Remains here. I'd love to just to hear some of your reactions of that piece and what that catalyzed of this collaboration that we now have here in 2025 with Blur.
Well, I saw All That Remains, and what I found exciting was a real translation of a tactile feel of the scenography and understanding the theater element and the intimacy and the poetry of the piece. And I really felt that it lived in this format in a very exciting way and began a conversation with Craig to see if we could find a way to collaborate.
And Craig, I know that you've been doing these back and forth between these theater for one, one-on-one encounters, and then moving into 360 video, and then now back in the theater now with Blur. We're kind of tying all these things together, but maybe take me back to 2022, where you were still in the early phases of experiments with one-on-one theater and then translate it into the VR. And then what were some of the initial conversations that you had with Phoebe in order to kind of take it to the next level?
Yeah, so I think that for us to go from the live performances to 360 VR, I mentioned before that we worked with Funique in Taiwan. And so really, in terms of performer relationship to camera, performer relationship with the audience, to how to create these intimate moments of encounter. And so over the course of the Just For You trilogy, we've been sort of focusing on that in 360 VR film. And what's really exciting from the first conversations with Phoebe is like, well, how do we start to expand that? How can we start to integrate these different creative languages so it almost becomes like this collage, like a Rauschenberg type painting, but instead of we're using paint and canvases and found objects, we're using the different languages of VR. And so what was really exciting is about I flew out to San Francisco to see Carne and Arena and The Infinite. And, you know, you walk into Carne Arena and they have like this chilled waiting room, and like the temperature of the room is like really important. And so like this physical sensation of that onboarding. And then they had sand on the room as part of the main part of the experience. And so the tactility of it. And so it really became, how can we start? So we went from live performance to 360 VR, where we sort of lost the haptic elements. We just sort of had, I put on the headset and I watched the experience, and really making a portable, you know, we can just bring it, put on the headset, and you're there. And now sort of almost taking a step back towards the more theatrical and really trying to reintegrate some of those, the tactility, like the smell and the taste and the touch, and to really sort of reemphasize the liveness of performance. And then think about how do we then can also have these fantastical moments where it becomes really cinematic, or with animation, what becomes possible. And so those early conversations really were a lot about the content, but also about how the structure of VR, how we can play with that medium and collage these pieces together.
And so from a narrative perspective, it sounds like that you'd come across articles around the woolly mammoth and cloning. And so maybe you could just share a little bit around this encounter with breakthroughs in biotechnology and how that catalyzed a deeper meditation on some of the themes that are explored in Blur.
Well, I think it was a great prompt to create a tapestry of questions that are relevant to today and contemporary, and also to situate it into an emotional journey of a woman who's lost her child. And it opens up questions that I think are really pertinent today with people's desire to see how we can live longer, what it means to de-extinct what was of the past, and think about it through the lens of sustainability, what will happen to the planet. You know, in the case of the woolly mammoth, the idea was to protect the Siberian tundra by reigniting these herds. So that was a very positive outcome. I think it then becomes questions where we might assume that there might be a positive outcome. What is the ethical questions and potentially the negative outcome? And these questions are constantly in evolution. And I think it was important for us to situate the piece in some of these questions as an entry point, as a prompt to develop these fantastic worlds and yet feel an emotional attachment to where we are living today.
Yeah, and it seems like that a lot of the grammar and language of your pieces lean into a lot of this dream logic and trying to do something that's unexpected or go in a direction where you're not quite knowing where it's going to go. And so just curious to hear around if it's a similar process that you used before in terms of like step by step what happens next, or if this piece, because it had a little bit more of a, or I guess all of them have a narrative through line, but this in some ways the narrative felt a little bit more clear in some of the topics that were being explored. And just curious around, you know, your own evolution of the way that you're telling these stories and your process of creating the step by step and iterative process that you've done in the past.
Yeah, I think our early conversations, like for the other three pieces for the Just For You trilogy, like each was about 10 or 11 minutes. And I think with those works, the brevity of them enabled it to be still more abstract. We didn't need to have a more concrete narrative line or structure. And I think we agreed that we needed to have something that was really going to sort of ground emotional content, an investment in these characters in this world. And so we arrived at the story of this mother, and I think that that through line still enabled us enough poetic space. We're not telling a story, we're creating these series of encounters, but with enough poetic space around them for the audience still to have their room to see and interpret and make personal connections. And so I think that in terms of the trajectory of the piece, you know, so we started in a very physical, the materiality of this installation world, the concreteness of that, the presence of it, you know, the texture of the walls, the smells of the space, the physical contact with the performer, it's really sort of putting you, okay, I'm grounded. And then there's a little magic trick at the beginning where you expect the room is one way and then something transforms and suddenly you're this magical transformation before you enter into the work. I think that building up expectations and then sort of destabilizing them, like I think I talked before about this idea of like pulling the carpet a little bit out from under the audience's feet. And it's not to harm them or, you know, we're really attentive to the caring for the audience, but to sort of help them enter this state where their mind isn't fully stable. And I think in that instability, they're able to experience work and process it in a deeper and more profound way. And so I think for us, it was like, as we were creating this collage, how do we ground it and then pull the carpet out from under and then enable them to fall into the work? And then with the collage of these different aesthetics, it really became important about how they fit together, how they make sense. And so Tomas, like a great programmer from Phi, really did a, you know, in terms of what technology is possible. So our early workshops, like, let's try this. Or there's some happy accidents, like we did something where they're just playing on the dial, we're doing motion capture, and like suddenly the actor's head could get really big and really small, and like, that's funny. And then so we're like, well, what if it even got smaller, and then it shrinks into the body, and then the body expands. And so some of it was just sort of playing with the mediums, so not just paint and wood, but with the VR itself, like what potential does that open?
Yeah, Phoebe, I'm curious to hear from your perspective of coming from a theater background, but also of seeing a lot of VR works over the years. There have been a number of pieces that have really leaned into this kind of dreamlike quality, dream logic. So just curious to hear a little bit your reflections as you're working with Craig on this piece, like how to shape that dream or, you know, still have that narrative through line, or, you know, just some of your reflections on the grammar and language of VR as a medium, because it feels like this is, again, a piece that I'm coming out with a lot of feeling and emotion, but also, you know, having a sense of like an arc of the story, but that's not the thing that I'm thinking of. I'm thinking about how my body went through this whole experience and how it felt like I was walking through a dream, and that within itself was really impactful. So just curious to hear some of your reflections on that type of leaning into the dream logic in VR and the language and grammar of VR.
Well, I think from a point of view of the dramaturgy, while I was working in the theater, I was really interested in the Buffon and the critical point of view, as well as the theater of the absurd. So we wanted to keep the irony and the critical thought alive in this piece as an anchor. I think also in how we approached the piece, it wasn't linear. It was, as you suggest, a series of conversations around, you know, what is the absurdity of Dolly, for example. So we wanted this hybrid, fantastic character, and really interested in having an authentic physical transition from a live dancer in mocap into this synthetic and authentic, you know, as far as the movement and embodiment. And we really wanted the audience to feel that. So not just for the sake of creating a surrealistic, dreamlike vocabulary, but really trying to challenge the experience of entering these worlds, as I think is, you know, in a contemporary generation where they're not only their physical selves, but they have a virtual comprehension of that transition and how to make that really authentic and embodied. And I think that this lens of the fantastic, of the surrealism, really does offer a wonderful platform, but yet anchored into something that they can feel in the tactile world. So the sensation of the feeling of the wind or the touch or the mystery of, I could have sworn there was a wall there and now it's disappeared, and that entry point into this virtual experience.
Yeah, and I'd say that as we were, you know, creating this work, like throughout, it was really because we didn't start off with a set beginning, middle, and an end. And so I think that it really was this iterative process of enabling the audience to go on this journey. And so it was like a physical journey. And so before, like for the trilogy, you would sit in a chair and watch it. And here, to like, you know, to physically, you, a curtain parts, you walk through and you go down the corridor and you enter into the work. And as we transition into sixth off for some of the sequences, like how to make it make sense for the audience, to sort of curate it in a way where everything was intentional, you know, like the pacing of it. And so as the actress is guiding you, she's guiding you at a particular pace, which sort of slows down your pace because, you know, you can't get ahead of her. And that sort of like as that pace sort of you start to settle into this experience, which is very contemplative almost. It's sort of slowing down your mind, it's slowing down your heart, and it's putting you into a state to encounter the rest of the work. And then, as Phoebe was mentioned, then have like sort of these comedic or like the bigger the dolly dance, suddenly we're shifting the language or the pacing of it. And so a lot of it was like how to make it make sense within the logic of the work, or in the post-apocalyptic where we have this huge, desolate, sort of sandy with cars and a woolly mammoth and these bones. And it's the scale of that. And initially it's like, well, if that's free roaming, I mean, we could only walk, you know, how big of a space would we have for the installation? And so coming up with resolutions or solutions to be able to have the vastness of this huge environment, but just keep the audience positioned and focused where we have 360, they're inside the world, but their movement is very limited. And so to have the infinite with limited motion, right? And sort of how to shift then afterwards, then they go down another elevator and they're into another space. And so constantly, again, like that expansion or contraction, like inhaling and exhaling around the audience.
Yeah, I want to come back to the pathing aspects of it, but I wanted to elaborate on the name of Blur and also the themes of genetic engineering, of like the blending and blurring of what's it start to mean when we are modifying ourselves, the genetics and the boundaries of ourself and identity, but also the structure and the ways that you're telling the story, that you're kind of blending and blurring different aspects of the physical installations, the theatrical elements, the 360 video, you have the mixed reality that's in there. And so you have a lot of ways that you're mixing and mashing all the different forms of the XR language, but also the themes that we're covering are also on those same topics of the blending and blurring of the boundaries of our identity and ourself, and what's it mean to start to modify that. So, yeah, I'd love to hear any reflections on the way that the structure and form of the story was also mimicking and mirroring the content of the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this idea of experimentation, of laboratory, I think when you enter into the work, I mean, it is almost like you're entering into the Petri dish, right? You become one of the elements that's being experimented on or tested. And so actually there's a number of images where you see scientists or doctors, they are working, and then there's a moment in the experience where you actually become the person in the laboratory who's the catalyst for the experiment happening. And I think that that fluidity of boundaries, where it's not sort of a set identity, or you're not playing the role of, you think you're individually, you're you. You walk in, it's never like, I now have to pretend like I'm someone else. But in this process, you sort of slip into these different roles. You know, for us, the first time we've collaborated together, as we're pushing together these different creative languages, I mean, it was a huge experiment for us. And to put the audience at the center or the core of that, I think sort of thematically, you know, was something that we were really intentional about. Also, there's scenes like where you actually will see stuff from the laboratory, you know, like with the Petri dish, it's on the floor and then it rises up and you pass through it. It's somehow, it's like the materiality, it's like, it's on you, or it's in you, or you became it. And I think that the fluidity of roles was really important.
If you have any reflections on the blending and blurring of both the title and the themes, but also the way that the story's told.
Well, I think we had some lively conversations and constantly pulling up documentation or research and opening up yet other questions and building images around some of these attempts at science. You know, it's such a rich tapestry and a moving target. You know, I think on Time magazine they had just resurrected the white wolf.
Yeah, the dire wolf. Yeah.
And so it's a very contemporary language and wanting to blur it into this experience, which is very theatrical and image-based, yet again opens up these questions of what if. So I think that drama is innate in looking towards the future and how humanity is answering questions that have never been answered before.
And Phoebe, I'd love to have you elaborate a little bit on the technical side around the number of people, because I know talking to Miriam, the Carne Arena, how to take that experience and kind of expand it out to have a throughput that is feasible as a business, but yet, you know, the most immersive would be to have a singular experience but just one person. And I feel like sometimes, like Excurio or even The Infinite, I felt like there were ways in which that there were people that were going through a group experience. Sometimes when I'm going on a guided tour, someone might be in front of me and occluding me in some ways that is distracting. I felt like with Blur, like the six people was like a really good sweet spot, but maybe a little bit more than a Carne Arena, but not as much as like, you know, The Infinite. So there seems to be like a kind of a throughput calculus here of like what makes sense as a business versus what can be exhibited. And so just curious to hear a little bit around how you start to explore that in terms of helping to produce this project and the constraints and boundaries that is put on creatively, because you're moving from the theater of one, now we're getting like groups of people. So I didn't feel like the other people were a hindrance and that there was plenty of room for each of us, but just curious to hear some of the different trade-offs that you're exploring with trying to find what is the number of people that you're trying to put through an experience like this comfortably in a way that doesn't diminish the experience, but also makes it feasible as a something that you could actually run and be profitable.
Well, certainly from my experience of having a more museum-like experience with many pieces, that's how we began. But then when I had seen the work from Felix and Paul, the documentary from the ISS, I really felt we really had to figure out how to create an accessible model and a sustainable model to support this content. So that's why The Infinite was born. Now, other questions today is how can we build something that is, as you mentioned, more intimate and transportable, yet sustainable, at least a break even. But I look at this as a piece of art. Will it sit in a museum? If you think of Kusama's The Infinite Room, you know, it sits in a museum around the world and it brings a lot of people who have that intimate experience of one, yet there's this progression to enter into that artwork. So I wasn't sure, is this a piece that lands in a museum or is it a piece that lands in a theater? And now just thinking about a contemporary vision towards museums or even projects that are adjacent to maybe a live performance, these are territories we'd really like to examine. So far, you know, there's an interest in the theater community as a distribution model adjacent to other programming, and I think that many theaters have, as we experienced in Taipei with the National Theater, an experimental or smaller black box. So it could live in a black box, and so far it seems to be accepted or inspiring the theater community.
I'd like to add something for us, like with Riverbed, we've never done this scale of a touring piece with VR. And so working with Fai and Julie, who's the head of the studio, was really, you know, that question of like sustainability. And so we don't want to create an amazing experience that one person will see, or we can stage it once and then it disappears. And so I think that Julie and the Fai team were really helpful about thinking about what are the parameters, like how many, you know, and so initially we wanted to have 20 people per hour. It's like, yeah. And so we arrived at 10 is actual, like sort of the largest it can be. And then we made it could be for 8 or for 6, and depending on the size of the venue to be able to scale the work. But I think that those questions of like, you know, finding a business model that works where, like you were saying, we want the audience to have the intimacy of this connection, of this personal encounter where, yeah, you just don't feel like you're part of a tour group, that it's your experience. And so I think that those conversations were really essential, and a lot of them, you know, because you start crunching numbers of like, well, what is a ticket price? And we don't want it to bail. If you make it 100 euros, you know, I'm sure enough wealthy people to come see it, but we want to make it affordable so, you know, college students can come see the work as well. And so I think this collaboration beyond artistically was also, you know, finding a business model or a structure that is sustainable and, you know, can sort of help share the work more globally.
And I guess another benefit to this piece is that there's kind of like a limited constrained space that you're able to really make the most use out of, as far as I can tell, you know, in terms of creating some modulations of space that put me into a state of wonder in terms of perverting my expectations, but also the pathing stuff that I can see, like maybe a DNA lineage from something like The Infinite or Excurio, where it's, you know, showing me where to walk and managing group experiences where you're able to guide and direct people to be in the right place so that they can continue their own experience but not interfere with someone else's experience in a way that allows me to be in a party group, go off my own, come back, and that, you know, I feel like in the experience I'm going through these vast spaces, but physically it doesn't seem like I'm going through a lot of spaces. So it feels like a piece like this at this small scale would also potentially have a lot more places that it could be shown in a way that may not have a lot of space, that you may not need something as big as like Excurio with these big open spaces. So I'm not sure if that's been a part of the trade-offs that you're evaluating and trying to make the most out of the spaces.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I'd say that, you know, even right now, Tomas, like the audience's path, like what's the way in a small space to have people, you know, moving, and like ideally it becomes this almost like a choreographed dance of like at this moment, and it's like bump and go. And you see in the ideal situation, all six people start walking at the same time and they're relatively close, but they won't bump into each other. And to really sort of like take care of the audience, tend to them. And I think that the detail that Tomas and the rest of the team have sort of put into that, it really like the dance of the experience, that even though we're not dancing, but there is this flow, there's a rhythm, there's a tempo, and that's very intentional.
There was a lot of detail, you know, in thinking through not only the tapestry that, you know, both Craig and I have seen a lot of work. So even the avatars, our own avatar, we had many discussions on how to create a unique language based on the audience experience. And, you know, to come into a rehearsal room and almost everyone's behind a computer is a completely different experience than our past lives. But every detail, from the synthetic texture of, as Craig was mentioning, to make it believable and not what we've seen again and again, was really the challenge and an inspiration for the developers. I think what is great is to see more traditional artists who are choreographers or composers or illustrators transition into this world of VR is quite exciting, and the developers who help us make that transition as seamless and authentic as possible, to me, is really exciting territory.
And with it, like Phoebe just mentioned the avatar, and that's something that was like such a that conversation happened 2.5 years ago, but like, you know, Edouard, one of the members from Phi, we're thinking, well, you know, when the audience sees you, they're like, well, what do we see? And it seems like a basic question, but it's so fundamental. So like in that first moment where we transition into VR, and we were like, are they smoke? Are they realistic? Are they scientists wearing lab coats? And then Edouard was like, well, what if they're like particles? And then like to see, and like, if we are then doing with like genetic engineering and cellular, I mean, just like visually it's beautiful, and also just conceptually it works. And so I think there's a lot of this experiment, this back and forth, these conversations, and like, and Phoebe and I and the rest of the team have like complete trust, are willing to try. And so we did try different iterations, like that looks really goofy, or that doesn't work. And then there's moments where like the particles can sort of float, or, you know, people shift into particles. And so, you know, this seemingly small decision becomes really foundational. And then it like, again, reinforces the themes of the piece in a subtle way.
Yeah, and some of my memories of the piece, well, I really enjoyed the piece, and I felt like it was continually put me into a state of awe and wonder, and just some really beautiful interactions, you know, having live actors, having the one-on-one interaction, the encounter, and then, you know, perversion of expectation, the modulation of space, the journey into the unknown, and yeah, and just kind of like these surreal, absurdist, you know, vignettes that also are tied in narratively into like, they weren't just totally random, they were part of the theme of the story, but also kind of in this absurdist, you know, exploration of, you know, this person dancing with different modulations of animals grafted on to them in a way that's a little hard to describe until you see it. But also these moments of like haptics of wind was really great. And I think I remember some smells that are like, oh, I remember remembering it, but smells can operate on this unconscious level where it kind of brings a memory that can often blur into the experience as well. So I just remember walking out of it, like waking up from a dream and being like, oh, that was a really powerful dream. I should write that down, because it was like, you know, something that was using a dream logic can mean that like it can kind of be a fuzzy memory of it, because it ends up being like associative links that go from one thing to the next. Then it makes sense in the moment, but it's a little bit of a train of thought that if it gets interrupted, then it's like, oh, what happened next? Or what did that lead to? Or, but I'm kind of left with similarly how it's a collage. I'm left with a collage of experiences that really just stuck with me. And I just walked out. I was like, wow, that was incredible. But if you were to ask me in that moment, what was the story? What was it about? I don't, that wasn't the thing that was the most on my mind. I sort of got, okay, there's genetic engineering and, you know, the through line of the mother and the son, you know, that I was focusing more on the body than the narrative, I guess. And so, yeah, but anyway, that's just some of my experience. I don't know if any reactions to that.
I think it's fantastic. That's, I think what we really wanted is that the through line is the through line just to sort of provide a structure. But I think it's our own personal reflections, our personal physical experience, our mental journey. You know, like someone just walked out this morning and like, you know, with like tears in their eyes. And again, it could be for the mother and the child, but I think somehow maybe it's more just sort of life. You know, like somehow, you know, loss, desire, presence, contact, solitude, these very fundamental human emotions, which are at the core of the piece. And so there is the larger de-extinction and resurrection biology, which we sort of were saying these terms now. 3 years ago, I didn't know what resurrection biology was or what de-extinction. And I mean, these terms, which are scary, but they're becoming part of our everyday vocabulary. But so, you know, there's the larger piece that has this structure, but at its soul and at its heart, I mean, it really is this loss, desire, impermanence. And I think that those are really human emotions and feelings and things that we struggle with, you know, throughout our life. And so I think leaving with that rather than a story or a theme or a message was something that we were both like pushing towards.
I mean, I loved your comment on feeling like you're waking up from a dream and might want to write some of it down. I think that dreamlike quality is important in the notion of the collage, but the seamlessness of traveling from one format to another, experiencing a multitude of sensation, I think is something that I'm happy that you felt was intact in the piece. And otherwise, I think Craig said it very well.
I think there is a blending and blurring of the different formats, and there was a moment where you switch back and forth between VR and 360 video, and then at some point you switch to like a live, the mixed reality video pass-through that thematically or the quality, I didn't clock immediately that it was a pass-through. It was sort of like, oh, I'm back to the 360 video because it had set up an expectation. And then walking forward, I was like, wait a minute, this is like pass-through because either they've come up with some sort of like radical breakthrough of volumetric video walking into a 360 video, or this is pass-through. So, but the pass-through quality was surprisingly good for how dark, and I don't know if it's the lighting or it just made it, there's often like some wobbliness in the Quest pass-through that can be really annoying, but it feels like the way that you pulled that off was also really brilliant in the way that it created a whole other surreal encounter that I think is unique to have this mix of what usually in one immersive theater you have like these one-on-one encounters. Maybe it's like a one-on-two encounter where there's one actor with two of the audience members, but yeah, that intimacy that you can get through that, and also that mixed reality moment in that piece that I think was also really stuck out to me as I was watching it.
Yeah, I think with the Oculus 3 with the headset, just sort of last year or like 2 years ago, it would have been like black and white and fuzzy. And this year, like with the update, we're like, oh, wow. And so again, with the team in Montreal, you know, we had the headset. I remember we actually, like, some of the people were on stage sort of dancing, and there actually happened to be a table that they were dancing behind. And like, oh, what if there's something behind, and then we can approach, and we have a distance and this interaction, and we started collaging together, piecing together, well, what would happen in that moment? But it was for us, like, to have that uncertainty. And so it's great to watch the audience in that moment where people are approaching and they don't know what they're approaching, and then when suddenly the hand reaches through the screen and makes contact, and, you know, the directions for the performers who are, you know, really attentive, like their intensity and focus and generosity with each performance, and like to be sure to touch the audience's hand as they're handing the object to them. You know, it's like everything is very intentional, very precise, and like it's a less than a second of contact, but it's important. They came through the screen, it's almost like a Videodrome type moment where they came through the screen, but they touched you, and then they're back in their frame. And I think that those moments of really exploring that medium and what was possible and sort of embracing. So last year, before the pass-through evolved to this point, we're like, well, does our image have to be really staticky so we can try to match what pass-through looks like? But now it's sort of advanced to a point where it really is. And then again, like lighting levels enable it to sort of have like the sharpness of image quality. So it's a really bright scene, which wouldn't work in theater, but for pass-through, you know, it was essential.
Yeah, and seeing this piece, and I've seen The Infinite as well, and seeing your previous three pieces there, it felt like, you know, a mashup of elements of The Infinite, of locomotion technology. So I noticed that there are like these little green things on the floor and some special tracking that, when I saw it in Tacoma, Washington, there was similar kind of a grids of things on the floor. But yeah, just ways that you're able to direct people into this experience. I don't know, Phoebe, if you want to mention anything in terms of the insights or lessons learned from being able to direct people in the way that you're able to take some of those insights and add it to a much more theatrical, deliberate staging of that, rather than of just kind of managing groups of people, but really creating a whole new language of theater in some ways, of allowing the switching between the collective into the individual that you can do with VR.
Well, certainly the navigation of the free roaming was vital in the constrained space. And with The Infinite, there was a certain agency that the visitor had, because you could visit a series of experiences at your choosing, but constrained within the wireframe of the ISS. I think we wanted to create a little bit of that sense of agency in the experience of Blur, but we really had to work with the developers to find the pathways that were so precise. And I think what Craig mentioned is the happy accidents that allowed us to say, okay, well, the pass-through works. We can figure out the crispness of it. We can figure out the framing of it. But how do we direct the audience? So, you know, if you look down, you have your own footprint. So you know where to go. And you land close to your visitor, but during the whole experience you don't recognize it with other people unless they come in your sphere. But it took a great deal of thought in terms of the navigation mechanisms that are quite abundant throughout the experience to make sure that people landed precisely where they needed to land.
Yeah, there's a bit of a mechanic of having like a dual circle that if you go outside of that boundary, it'll fade to black and they'll just be those two circles and a please return to the experience. And I feel like there's a good mix of freedom of some sorts of going to where you're supposed to go. But, you know, there was one moment where I walk into a big, vast open room and then I'm like, oh, I'm going to walk over to this thing. And then I get the message that I went too far. And so there was like, oh, okay, well, I don't actually have that much agency to explore this specific room. But I felt like that it was a nice balance of being able to allow me to choose where to go. And if I go beyond that, then it's going to reel me back in. But I was surprised sometimes that, you know, I was able to go and get a different view, or I was still within the bounds, even though it's not always explicit as to what the chaperone is. And so I feel like it's a nice mix of trusting the audience enough to know that they're going to figure it out and use their intuition about what makes sense intuitively to what to do, but also to have a fallback to, if they don't do what you want them to do, that they could go back to where they're supposed to go to not only protect their own experience, but to prevent them interfering with other people's experience. So I felt like there's a number of moments that I felt like that was a really nice balance that you're able to achieve as well.
Yeah, again, like a very iterative process. You know, there's like one moment where you enter a big room and you do have that. And so we tried to trigger the next sequence earlier and push that moment closer to you to prevent the audience from walking off course. And so ideally, we've tried to structure it like as much as we can to try to be able to guess the audience's response. And it's almost like, yeah, when we're doing the performance for an audience, someone, like, how do we know where the audience is going to look? Or how can we create a structure that really helps guide them look here now, right? And I think that it's making very, you know, in terms of lighting, in terms of sound, you know, working with Yujun and Alun, who were the sound designers for all the Just For You trilogy, you know, they're really attentive to sort of make these immersive sounds, but also to have sounds be triggers to help focus. You know, to really shape the experience, because we do have those safety fallbacks. So if you do go too far, that'll come up. But ideally, really trying to minimize the amount of times that that happens, or there are, you know, safety barriers if you get too close to the wall. But, I mean, we don't want to interrupt the experience. We want to put you in the work. And so Tomas and the team did a great job of having those as backups. But I think the curation of the choreography, we spent a lot of time to make it intuitive, to help guide the audience in a way that wasn't too constraining, but also provided a framework that put you on the right course.
Hmm. Yeah. Also notice that there's a bit of magic trick quality to this piece where, you know, you see it, and I'm hesitant to even talk around some aspects of the experience because I feel like I don't want to get into too much of the spoiler territory, but I'm just curious how you handle that as guidance for people who see it and what to share or not to share. It feels like it's a hard experience to fully describe. And even if you tried to describe it, I don't think you'd be able to fully give a sense to someone. So I feel like in some ways the spoilers are mitigated, but there are things that you don't expect to happen that do end up happening. And so just curious, as producers of a piece like that, how you protect the integrity of the magic.
Well, our marketers are very clever. And I think asking questions that evoke curiosity just by the theme. But I think the combination of the live actor and this virtual transition, I think, is in this format is compelling. And I think building a language to keep the audience at the center of the experience and give them what they need to understand how to navigate, but at the same time trusting that their intuition and their experience, I believe that they will navigate by the care that we gave to thinking about a clarity in the language.
And I think something that we, like Phoebe mentioned, that we had a number of workshops. And so we had workshops in Montreal. We had Onassis Culture as one of the co-producers of the work. So we're able to go to Greece. And we went to Greece. We actually had like more of like a physical installation. And it was like too much in the middle of the space, and we're like, well, that doesn't work because of like these safety concerns. But I think something that was really important for us as we were working throughout the process was to, once the audience enters the world, they're inside the work, and so you never fully see the outer world, so you're always in it. And so that was something really important about like our, when you're talking about like, well, the images that we're disseminating or that people can see, I don't want them to see, you know, even though the walls here on the immersive island are beautiful and they have the graffiti, I mean, like all this, I mean, this is beautiful, but I want them to be in the work. And I think that Phoebe and I really sort of emphasize the process of, like, the audience, they don't know how big the space is behind that. Or, you know, when we did the show at the National Experimental Theater in Taiwan, the audience, someone actually like, is there an elevator? I didn't know. I've worked here for 20 years. And so suddenly it's playing with expectations in a way where the audience really is entering the unknown. And I think sort of maintaining the integrity of the space, of being in the world of the aesthetics of Blur, I think was really essential. And so, yeah, it's difficult to talk about it because we don't want to say scene A, scene B, scene C. We want the audience to experience it. But yeah, but always inside it. Yeah.
Yeah. As I think about this piece and distribution in this middle place, you know, you go to blockbuster movies, lots of people see them, and there's like the art house films. This feels like a kind of an art house type of immersive theater piece that is very beloved within the community. It's hard for me to judge like if people off the street see this, if they have the same reaction of people here that have seen a lot of stuff and really appreciate it. So I'm not sure if you've been able to show it off. I know you premiered it in Taiwan ahead of here, but I'm just curious if people that maybe their first VR experience and what kind of reactions you get from people who are not industry veterans who are watching a piece like this.
When we showed it in Taiwan, so we premiered at the Taiwan National Theater, and then we showed it at the National Taichung Theater, or Taichung National Theater in central Taiwan. And it was fantastic because we would get a lot of, I think the number of people that have seen VR is smaller, and they're also getting, there's some 70, 80-year-old grandfather who came in, and the first moment there was this using motion capture and this contact, he started slapping away the performer's hand. He was dancing with, there's the dolly, the dance sequence, he's dancing with them. And it was really amazing to see people who don't have maybe the same background or experience with VR, for this to be their first journey into it was really magical. And today, someone in one of the moments literally screamed, just sort of the response was so big that uncontrolled or people laughing, and it's great. I think that for people that are in the industry, there's a lot of experiments that maybe that's what they're focusing on, or the language of it. And I think for folks that maybe don't have as much experience, there's also a different pleasure and satisfaction about what they're experiencing or encountering.
What have been some of the reactions that you've heard here at Venice?
I think they appreciate the poetry of the piece, and I think that they are satisfied with the effort we made to make them feel comfortable and experience the storytelling in a coherent way, as well as offer an opportunity to the experimentation that we were pushing our boundaries to see how far we could go to really develop this multiple format experience.
Awesome. And finally, what do you each think is the ultimate potential of immersive storytelling and this type of fusion of theater and XR, and what it might be able to enable?
Before I answer that question, I want to do a small advertisement. I just really wanted to go back over the course of this project. So the Taiwan Creative Culture Agency, with this international co-production grant, which really provided sort of the feed money to approach FI, and we have this, and then sort of, the scale of that, and then Onassis Culture coming in, working with Taika in Taiwan. They also had with IP Labs, who are doing volumetric capture. The languages and the people that we've been able to bring on board, Phoebe knowing Edward Locke, and so having this amazing choreographer working on this piece, the Riverbed team creating the first installation of the set, sort of having these moments, it was really, this journey has enabled the scale of this experiment. And so I think as our first large-scale co-production, it's been fantastic. And then as we start thinking about the possibilities of these immersive works, I think that for us, the scalability, maintaining the intimacy and the individual and the collective experience. And so I'm not sure where this ends up, but I think that right now we're really exciting place to continue this journey as this work sort of continues to tour and sort of go around the world. Yeah.
I think it's really exciting territory to continue to do the research, and as Craig was saying, combining these artists and developers from Taiwan, compounding resources from the knowledge we have in Montreal, having the luxury of time to experiment, inspiring new practices, and finding pathways for more traditional artists to have a different platform. I think that it's such a shifting landscape, but I find it tremendously exciting.
Is there anything else left unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community? Any final thoughts?
Jiayou. That's Chinese for yay! I think that as a newcomer here in 2022, when I met Phoebe, it's really amazing. So if you haven't been to Immersive Island, come. The conversations you have, the artists you meet, the possibility, the doors that open, and the receptiveness of being a newcomer here 3 years ago, and now as we were talking, I was waving to so and so is passing by, and it's a very big family here, and a very receptive and open family, and the opportunities for collaboration that really, for Riverbed, this is a huge step. And made possible by being here and meeting Phoebe and the FI team, but by being here, by being present. And so I think that these festivals and events really are an amazing platform for connection. And I think in a very divisive time, it's amazing to have this community exist.
Well, coming from an international theater school, landing here in this international immersive VR festival is amazing, and I think it needs to be supported. And I think that, to Craig's point, it is a family. We are sharing resources, we are sharing our experience and finding ways to continue to create good work and create sustainable models for the future.
Awesome. Well, Craig and Phoebe, thanks so much for joining me today on the podcast. And after seeing all of the program this year, I feel like that Blur is a very strong contender to take home one of the top prizes at Venice this year. You know, as I was walking out, I was just really awestruck and just felt like in this liminal, numinous quality to it that, you know, just kind of sticks with me in a way that you're using all the modulations of how to tell stories in a way that gets to the deeper spirit of a story that gets put into my body in a way that I think is unique to the medium of VR. And I think it's a sign of where things are going to go as you continue to kind of explore the grammar and how to combine all these things together. And it's just a really powerful experience, and looking forward to see where you take it all here in the future and for more and more people to see it. I know as I talk to people, it's, you know, one of the hottest tickets of people trying to get in and see and imagine. A lot of people trying to call in some favors to get some extra seats and stuff. There's only 6 people at a time to see it, but yeah, it's a really great piece, and I'm looking forward to see where both of you take it here in the future and tour it around so more and more people can see it. So thanks again for joining me here on the podcast to break it all down.
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for tuning into this Venice Immersive 2025 coverage. And hopefully you found some use in some of this documentation of these experiences that are very ephemeral. And some of these show at these festivals and they don't really go out widely beyond this a lot of times. I mean, maybe they are, but you may not be in a place that it's easy for you to see them. And so it's a real privilege to be able to see all these experiences, but also to be able to sit down with these creators and have a really deep, in-depth conversation in a way that there are not a lot of other opportunities to really dig into at this level. And so I really appreciate all the time from all the creators to be able to have these conversations, but also for you to take the time to listen to them. And also, it's been a challenge of trying to find a way of speaking about these experiences in an abstract, theoretical way, or at least in a way that I can ground it and allow you to put yourself into the experiences to kind of imagine some of these different things that they're doing, how I'm experiencing it, but also the different types of design decisions that the creator is making. So if you find this useful and want to support this type of effort of both documenting the history of immersive storytelling, but also to support this kind of wildly ambitious independent journalism project that is very much driven by support by listeners like yourself, so please do consider becoming a member of the Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.